Hey everyone, Tyler here. Before you listen to this episode, I just wanted to prep you for some issues that arose when we were putting it together. So we recorded this when we were getting our bearings in the early days, and this was Dox's first time being the host. As this was my first time in the passenger seat, I made a pretty stupid mistake and didn't check which microphone I was using to record. So instead of my normal microphone coming through, my voice ended up coming through a really shitty webcam mic. Now, as you might imagine, the audio on my end for this particular episode is not too good. So we just wanted to apologize to you for that. Always remember, kids, check your inputs and your outputs when you're recording and make sure that your audio quality sounds good before you finalize stuff. Anyway, with that in mind, Doc's put together a pretty fun episode here. So let's jump in.
Welcome to Codex Wax, the video game history podcast. My name is Dax, I am your host.
And I'm Tyler, your co-host.
This is a podcast about video game history. Each episode, we tell a story about one aspect of video game history. In this episode, I tell a story and Tyler comes along as my Watson, so to say, to ask questions and to help you and me and him comprehend what's going on.
Yes, so we're reversing roles this week. I'm pretty excited about it. I get to be in the passenger seat for once, and I'm pretty excited to hear what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, we'll see. But first, how are you? Is everything cool?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask you. Everything's good. I'm just, those of you who don't know a lot about me, I'm presently in my last year of grad school, and so I'm trying to finish a dissertation.
Ooh, exciting. Yeah.
I mean, as exciting as
dissertation work is.
Dissertation work is, and looking at data sets about congressional bills, right? Ooh, oh boy, real rager of a Friday night.
That gets your heart pumping, right?
Yeah. I've been playing some games, though. Lately, I beat Dark Souls 1 since the last episode.
Congratulations. The last boss is easy. You did a good job.
The last boss
there.
Is way easy. Thank you. Well, you know, you just dump a bunch of points into strength and endurance and vitality and get a big sword and you can just beat that whole game pretty easily. Yeah. Well, I mean Dark Souls easily, I guess.
Yeah, but you did the easy strength Havel's armor build. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that Havel's armor is cheating, but maybe it is. I don't know. It's in the game, you can get it.
It's fine.
Yeah. But Dark Souls 2, I started Dark Souls 2 and it feels a lot smoother. I can see why maybe people had issues with it, but
yeah, people
like
hate it.
It.
They despise the game, and
yeah,
it's understandable because it's really janky all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
While
yeah.
Dark Souls 1 felt really condensed. Is this going to be our thing? Are we going to talk about Dark Souls in every intro? And then just
well, it's just it's topical right now. I'm it also is, playing Dragon Ball Z Kakarot, which.
Nice.
Is totally a campy version of watching the DBZ show, and instead you're playing it. And
it goes through the entire story, right? But only from the DBZ start. So
yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't go through Dragon Ball.
Okay, that would be cool.
You're correct. So what do you got for me today, man?
Okay, so I thought about what to talk about, and until now we have only talked about self-made computer game developers or people that came in from other areas of practice and could use their skill in the area of video game design.
Okay, that's true.
Nowadays, video games have become such a huge part of culture that nowadays it actually has become its own field of study. And so if you dream of becoming a video game designer, you can actually apply to a video game school and learn how to become a video game designer. And today we are going to look at someone that actually took that path and will, by doing that, create something that all of us know and love, which is a great video game that we'll reveal later on, of course.
So you're saying that we're going to talk about a person, just to review, who went to school to learn how to make video games instead of, just some scruffy bunch of kids making video games.
Yeah, like those Naughty Dog boys from last episode that just started making games and all of a sudden were rich developers. Yeah. So the person we'll talk about is called Kimberly Swift. She's going to be the protagonist.
Okay.
And it's kind of the late 90s. She's in her first year of high school, junior year. And she knows that she wants to develop computer games. But many of us had the idea of, I want to be a computer game designer. I want to turn out to make games when I'm grown up. She had the same problem that we had, that she didn't know where to start, how to do it. So she started, of course, as many young adults that don't know what to do with their lives, they start to talk to someone that they trust, which for her was her parents, and especially her dad. And her dad had a coworker that told him about a school close to her, which is DigiPen in Redmond, Washington.
DigiPen?
DigiPen, yeah. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. Maybe DigiPen, or it's like Digi as in digital and pen as the pen you use to write.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
What did you say what year this was?
This is in the late 90s. I don't know the exact year. The interviews are unclear about it. It must be something like 99 or 98.
Okay.
Yes. It's kind of a digital technical institute that specializes in teaching the art of creating computer games. So in preparation to apply to the school, Kimberly decided to take two semesters of C++ courses, which is a programming language, so she could prepare to apply to the school and get a better chance of getting into the school. And she actually got into DigiPen's RTIS program, which means real-time interactive simulation, which according to Kimberly was just some fancy words for computer science that the school used.
Right. Do you know C++?
I have to learn C++ in my university. It's rather difficult. And I'm only starting myself, and it's a very, very frustrating process. So learning a year of C++ in high school must also be a very frustrating progress that she went through.
I would imagine. So not only you know some programming languages, but some of the people in our community know programming languages. And I'm always astonished because it is like a language, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that this is necessarily comparable, but when I run statistical analyses, I have to write up like a chain of commands and they all have to be executed in a certain order. And sometimes even using something as simple as like my program Stata is a little mind-boggling to me. So I think that people who can learn programming languages are impressive to me, at least. Just even from my little dip, dipping my toes into that water just a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's getting someone that can teach you well and learning, most importantly, the strategies how to program, because you can't solve the huge problem. You always have to break it down into smaller problems. And mostly if you learn programming, you don't learn the languages, but you learn problem solving. So yeah, it's the year 2002. She got into DigiPen Technical Institute. And to her surprise, the amount of computer science knowledge she learned in those two semesters in high school were easily surpassed by the density of knowledge that was poured into her by DigiPen within the first few weeks. So I don't know if you know that from university when you started out, but I know the feeling. Like, you come from high school, you go into university, and they just smack you in the face with fast you got to learn, especially in the first year.
And I think what was interesting to me in undergrad, and then even to a greater extent in grad school for me, was just how much more self-directed it is. So
absolutely.
Like, people don't care if you fail out of their class. Like, why would they? You're just one less person that they have to grade. And so, yeah, they can throw an overwhelming amount of information at you, and it's up to you to absorb it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody bothers with you. And if you don't get your knowledge, nobody will give it to you.
Right.
When asked in a few interviews if she was already fiddling with computer games back then at that starting point of university, she kind of says, quote, "Not particularly. I was mainly trying to keep my head above water, really, with all of the schoolwork. I had a few ideas here and there, though. Whenever our games team would start to figure out what we were going to do for our project, we would all pitch in various ideas," end of quote. So what we hear there, that they have kind of development teams in the school they went to. And it kind of worked like this. The entire curriculum was built around the idea that they would have these groups over the entire course of the program, which would be 4 years. And in these groups, they would have to create one game each year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So she was part of a group that was called, they had a name for themselves, and they were called Nuclear Monkey Software.
Okay.
They had kind of a logo that looks like a nuclear hazard sign, but there's a little monkey in the middle that throws something that kind of seems to look like poop. I'm not sure. It's a weird little logo, and it has a lot of NMS on it.
Well, you know, that's like, I don't know what the hell was up with, like, the early 2000s and this weird obsession with monkeys that would throw poop. It was like, I don't know if you experienced this in Germany. But
a great monkey poop beckoning.
Yeah. So I remember, like, walking into Hot Topic, and there was just all this stuff about monkeys flinging shit, and I don't know why that was funny at the time, but there was definitely a very brief period in culture where that was like a thing. So I'm not surprised given that it came out of that time period.
Yeah, also, maybe that was a cultural phenomenon. Yeah.
Fun fact, I think I read somewhere that monkeys don't do that in like normal life. They don't just randomly pick up shit and throw it. It's like a captivity thing when they can't express themselves.
Yeah, I think humans do that too when kept in cages for too long.
Yes.
Well, because you... Yeah, that's an interesting topic.
That's a nice dark path that we just treaded. So
awesome. Shall we dig deeper or go on with Nuclear Monkey Software?
All right. Well.
Okay. Let's continue. So they have this group. It's a bunch of programmers. They are all students, and you can still find the documentation from back in the day. They kind of had a little website they made themselves. They probably had to do some marketing courses too, where they probably had to build this website to kind of promote their studio as if it was a real studio. Stuff like that. And it also exists with all of the documentation of the games they build. It's kind of funny. So this is kind of the moment where we'll once read all of the names of the team, because it's kind of important to mention that it was not just Kimberly Swift that will have done the games that we talk about, but it's a team of several people that will stick with her for the entire time.
Right.
So the team consisted of Kimberly Swift, Kim Swift. She was producer and programmer. Garrett Rickey, designer and programmer. Dave Kircher, tech director and programmer. G. Barnett, product manager and programmer. Realm Lovejoy, she was an artist. Scott Clintworth, also an artist. And Paul Graham, also an artist, because at DigiPen you could also learn the design video games. So yeah, that's the team. That's what Nuclear Monkey Software consisted of. And on their homepage, they kind of wrote an introduction to themselves that kind of says a lot about what it must have felt to be at that school at that time with those people. Let's quote.
Cool.
Nuclear Monkey Software, founded in 2002, started as a small team of 7 humble programmers and 1 crazy person. Previous projects such as Gun Fu, Disco of Crime, and Desert Derby, Sexiness Run Rampant, brought joy to thousands. Today, it is even smaller, distilled to 4 core programmers. They are also recently joined by 4 artists who appear to be bizarro reflections of the programmers. Does this not remind you of the episode when Superman and Bizarro team up to defeat the Green Squid? If it does not, then you are probably a Green Squid in need of defeat from the explosive fusion of video game developing death. But wait your turn. They must first focus on their powers on Narbacular Drop. Okay, the last 2 words made no sense. Narbacular Drop. That is the name of their final project that will be highly important for this story.
So that was so cringy. That was so cringy.
It is super cringy.
Okay. I was going to ask, can you repeat Dave's name for me? Dave Keary?
Kircher. I say it the German way. I think he must have, like, it's a CH, so you probably would say Kircher. Okay. I don't know. It's K-I-R-C-H-E-R.
Okay. I feel like I've heard this guy's name before, but anyway, it's fine.
Could be. He's in a company, you know. Okay, so Narbacular Drop is the game that would be their final project. And these different projects that they were given always revolved around different stages of game development skill they had acquired. So the first, in the freshman year, they had to build a text-based game, and it got more and more complicated as the years passed and their skill increased. So there's one game they did in their pre-senior year, 1 year before they had to do Nabacular Drop, the final game they did. And they kind of, they made a little box cover for it with kind of a description of what the game is about. And it looks pretty hilarious and about as cringy as what I just read you. Maybe a little bit worse. So let's get into that. It says, Desert Derby, sexiness run rampant. The Indian Racing Corporation is using nanites to turn fun-loving racing hobbyists into wholesale sand. The only way to survive is to win. Fight for your right to not be turned into grey goo. Race for glory on the planet Zender and blast your rivals with a full 360-degree plasma turret. Speed your way through gnarly tracks created by the Animas team. Take on up to 15 of your friends. Build and customize your own tracks and terrain. Original soundtrack by Hip Hop Lords of Arabia. And much more.
Wow. I would play the shit out of that game.
It sounds kind of fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, like it sounds like great.
Free-roaming Mario Kart racing game.
What year did this come out?
It was never published. You can't even download it on the page. There's like two screenshots on the page. And the thing is that, I'll skip ahead a bit, this DigiPen kept all the rights to all the games created within the school. So it's rather difficult to get the games.
That makes sense. It's really weird how universities do that. I think technically when I publish my dissertation, my parent university owns it, as weird as that is.
That's very weird, isn't it?
But I would have to look into the legality of that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but that's DigiPen does it the same way. And that's, I guess that's why you don't have access to many of the games that they created anymore. Maybe they were also terrible.
Could be.
Maybe they. But I really think that this captures the entire atmosphere that their projects must have had, also where they created them. Because you must imagine under what enormous pressure they must have been at the time, because they needed to progress in video game school. And the only place that they were able to completely goof off was inside of these projects, because they had nothing else. They had, if you're at university at that time, you don't have time for anything. And I think it's a pretty hilarious way to vent your stress.
Yeah, I was thinking when you were saying that, it would be a good outlet, right? Like an outlet for all of your frustrations in school.
Yes, I think so too. So yeah, the school years pass, Nuclear Monkey Software completes the projects they were required to make, and Kimberly Swift reaches senior year together with her team. And they have to come up with their final project. And the general topic of it is build a 3D application that has physics. That's it.
Okay. So it can be anything as long as it has physics. Okay.
And this is where we stumble across how they pick their final project. And I think this is where you will know what game we will talk about.
We'll see.
Kimberly says in a few interviews that the main principle of choosing a project was one thing, and that is they need jobs. And Kimberly Swift just said, quote, "The impending doom of our student loans was hanging over our heads, and we wanted to eat." And she actually uses this comparison in several separate interviews and talks she does a few times. And I think it very well illustrates the dread they must have felt that was building up due to their student loans that they had to take out and finance studying. And it was kind of accumulating over their heads like a Damocles sword.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can relate better than I.
From
the same country.
Well, see, you've got things a bit easier over there in Germany. I might have said this to you before, but if I had all the money that I had out in loans right now, I could buy a really nice house just about anywhere in the country. Like, if all that debt was money I had, I could just go buy a really nice house with it.
That's a lot of debt, man.
Why aren't millennials buying houses? They're destroying the economy. Oh, I don't know, because I can't afford one, like, ever. I saw something on Twitter one day, and it was like something. It was something, and it was like, I realized that someday I'll have a house when my parents die.
So exactly this dilemma is why her whole motivation is we just gotta get hired by someone after this, or we just starve on the street. It's just gonna happen.
So then he jumps.
So even before final year started, they started planning to kind of get ahead of the game. She kind of talks about that in the former years, they were always too late for their projects and they never started on time and it always got too close. And they were like, if we do this now, we will literally starve. Mm-hmm. We gotta make this work. They started pitching ideas. And the first thing that they came across was the main mechanic of the game. And because one of the programmers, Dave Kircher, we talked about before, he had been working about this game mechanic in a 3D environment that used portals. So you could put a portal on one wall and another wall, and you could look into the other and out the other. And I mean, this obviously reveals where this is going.
Right. Yeah. So this is the game Portal, is what you're telling
yes.
me.
Yes. But they will not design Portal. They design something else.
Interesting.
That will lead up to Portal.
Okay.
Which makes this more interesting. So they kind of come up with the idea of creating this environmental puzzle, in which you have to use these portals to solve the puzzle. So it's already pretty close to what Portal will actually be later on. The concept is still not completely worked out, because at that moment they could only see through the portals. There was no kind of physics going on that they could use with them, or they couldn't move through them and stuff like that. And they also came across a few big disadvantages they had as video game developers that they had to kind of get rid of or kind of cancel out. And that was, they lacked a lot of resources. They didn't have any money to spend on development, as all the other developers we've got to know had. Lots of them, they started out with no money often, but later on they always had funding. They could throw into neat, fancy machines that basically made their games work much better.
Right.
And they were a small team of workers, and they weren't getting paid. They actually had to pay the school to do work, so they were getting a negative income.
What? So they had to pay the school to use their facilities?
They had to pay student loans.
Oh, they're still in school. I'm sorry.
This is still the school process. This is their final project for school.
Okay.
And they have to do this to graduate.
Okay, I see now.
And they lack expertise. They have no idea how to do this. And they only have this main concept they kind of have to stick with. And they kind of have to make it work, to make it something special, to not starve. This is still the idea. We got to make money. We got to make this special. But they also think that they had kind of a few advantages. And that is, first, if you're as free as they were in doing anything you want, you have no publisher breathing down your neck. Nobody's going to force any demographic on you, any kind of design you have to include. You don't have to be funny if you don't want to be funny. You don't have to fill any kind of niche. And that kind of helped them a lot.
Yeah, it seems like they had creative freedom in that regard.
Kimberly said something along the lines of, we would not be forced to create a game entirely focused around the demographic of 12-year-old girls that like to play volleyball. But if you had a great idea for that demographic, nobody would stop you from doing it.
Right, right.
She also added an interesting advantage that they had in creating what would be called Nabacula Drop. That's the game that they are designing with the portals.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that they had what she called video game awareness. And she said, quote, even though you are a student, being a young is actually on your side. You have quite a bit of video game awareness just because you have grown up in an age where video games are prevalent and popular source of entertainment. You have almost as much video game awareness as a lot of people in the industry.
How interesting. I never thought about this before. So, yeah, you would have a different perspective than someone who grew up previous to video games being ingrained into popular culture.
Absolutely.
And that might give you, well, I mean, she just said it, but that might give you advantages that you might have over someone else. That's pretty cool. Huh. I had never thought about that before.
And that is absolutely why they also thought that this was a good idea, because they thought, I think we can make this work. But the biggest reason they thought that the portal idea was a good idea, and I think this is interesting, is that innovation is hyper cheap, especially if you're a student. She says innovation is low cost as an independent, because you have nothing to lose. The worst case scenario is you get a bad grade, you still kind of graduate, but there isn't a multi-million dollar franchise behind what you're doing. So if you mess this mechanic up, is this main mechanic of the game, it's fine. And also you're competing against nobody if you have something new. And the portal idea was entirely new, and they were aware of that because they had video game awareness.
That's That's interesting to think about the pressure that companies put onto developers to make games in a certain way. I'm thinking about, like, I don't know, World of Warcraft. I used to play a lot of WoW. And the core idea of World of Warcraft is pretty cool, and at least it was for the time. But over time, I feel like there have been pressures from Activision Blizzard to make the game more grindy, to make the game more of a chase than it used to be, to keep subscriber numbers up. And so, I mean, of course, this isn't a one-to-one example, but the idea that you don't have the pressure from that company and it gives you the ability to innovate, I could see would be very useful. I mean, we talked about the Naughty Dog guys, not to keep going back to the last episode, but there were times when those guys wanted to make a specific game and could not, or had pressure.
Because their publishers wouldn't let them. They were, right. Or that one time when the Naughty Dog guys got this comedian from their publishers to make their game funny, and they were like, oh, what the fuck? Why do we have to do this?
Exactly.
That must be a terrible feeling. So yeah, she says, if you innovate, you don't have to compete. You're on your own in the direction you're going. And that's kind of how they felt about, this is how we're going to make money. This is how we're going to stand out. This is how we're going to get hired and paid for what we are doing. The culmination of all of these thoughts kind of led up to the situation where they went like, okay, we got to make this game. It's going to be about portals. It's going to be just about that. And we're going to make it work. And we're going to get hired. And it's going to be fine. So they stuck with that idea, and they kind of had to come up with a name for it. And we heard it a few times already, a Snapbacular Drop, and you're like, this doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And Kimberly says that one of her colleagues came up with it, with the main idea of, if you Google that name, nothing else should come up. That's the whole concept of the name, which is the case. If you Google Snapbacular Drop, nothing will come up except for Portal, because those two are intertwined, as you will see. They stuck with Snapbacular Drop, and after choosing their core principle, kind of had to figure out what was fun about those portals. Because as we heard before, it's important to figure out where the first fun of your game is. And in an interview, Kimberly explains how if you develop a game, you got to fiddle around with your core mechanic a lot, like iterate through it over and over again until you figure out what's fun about it and then stick to that. And as they went through the analysis of the mechanic, they kind of figured out a few neat applications they could add to the portal. And adding these multitude of applications to a single mechanic of the game is what Kimberly often refers to in many interviews as the Nintendo factor. Mm. And she explains this the following way by using Mario, actually. And that's in Mario has the ability to jump, which is a very simple mechanic. But you don't just do a single thing with jumping. You do numerous amounts of things. For example, you can jump onto things to defeat them, enemies. You can jump at boxes to open them up. You can get to a bigger height to get higher up. Or you can even evade things. Mm. And this is what they thought about when they were like, okay, we got to have this mechanic and it has to do a lot of things for us. It has to have that Nintendo factor that will make it fun, because you can use it in so many different ways, which will make the game feel more dynamic.
That's really interesting.
And as you know, these portals will later turn out to have exactly that, because you can, in Portal, if you know the game, it's kind of a puzzle game where you have to set these portals onto walls, and kind of you maybe have to move a box to a different area. Maybe you have to get across a gap, and you can put a portal on your side and on the other side of the gap, and then you can move through the portal and get through there.
What's really cool is how they mess with the physics, not to cut ahead in our story here, but how you can really screw with physics in a way where you can throw yourself off a ledge and point a portal at the ground and use the momentum of your fall to rocket yourself out of a door and like the other portal. And so you can do these crazy jumps by using your own gravity and by using the physics of the game. And I think it's really cool and really innovative.
Yeah, and that's actually, I think that's the most fun part of it, that you can do these, keep your momentum of a fall and kind of reuse it in another jump, which makes the game sometimes incredibly fast-paced, even though it's actually a pretty slow game. Mm-hmm. And they actually had that mechanic of keeping your momentum while falling through portals. That was implemented in Snapbacular Drop already. They kind of made that work, and I feel like there's no proof of that. I didn't read about it, but I think once they figured that out, they must have known this is something nice. This is fun. Because I remember when I played Portal for the first time, And I started figuring out how to use the momentum and the weird physics you can do with the portals. It was super fun. So the general gist of Nabecula Drop is like this. You kind of walk around in first-person perspective, kind of like a first-person shooter, but you don't have a gun. You kind of have this magic staff. It's kind of a fantasy setting. You're a little wizard. You start out in a cage, and you have to save a princess. Because they were all about, we want the people that sees us to focus on our core mechanics, so let's make everything else as tropey as possible, so you right. don't even pay attention to it. It's just a wizard, just a princess. You got this lava, nothing you haven't seen a billion times in sure. million computer games. Also probably pretty simple to draw the textures for.
Right, yeah, you have a lot less to worry about then. There's a million different wizards that you could look at rather than, I don't know, some alien or something.
And there's like boxes you have to move onto, buttons to open doors. There's enemies that walk around that you have to get rid of to not die, stuff like that. It's basically what Portal later on will have to. It looked like a dungeon crawler that's super dark all the time. Everything is brown or red. You see nothing really. Do you know these old dark games where you had to increase the brightness of your screen to actually see what's going on? Kind of feels like this. I mean, it has an old school feel like that. One of the things I did for this is I actually played the game that they created, Nabecula Drop. It got finished, and that one you can still download for free.
No way, that's awesome.
And I think what kind of stands out, it already is a lot like Portal. A lot of the rooms look exactly as the puzzle rooms that you will see in Portal. There's like big parallels that you can see. And you can really see that they basically created the game already. But how did they turn out to be Portal if they already had the game? That's the big question, right?
Right. I'm curious how they got wrapped up with Valve.
Yeah. It takes 8 months to develop the game. And they weren't just doing that project. They had classes on the side. So they were still studying, still writing tests. They were not only concentrating on making their game. So this was a stressful 8 months for them. And Kimberly once says that they basically never slept, then just did homework and coded all day. That's what they did.
That's impressive, by the way. To be in your senior year of, you know, undergrad, you have other classes, and you are coding a game of Portal's caliber in 8 months. That's nuts.
While doing that, you constantly are reminded that if whatever you're doing right now doesn't work out,